Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. If you sat down to write some church history in 1965, the year that the Latin Mass Society was formed, it wouldn't have been obvious that the liturgy and the theology of the Latin Mass would become such a central issue of contention that it had the capacity to divide the church just 55 years later. Today we welcome Dr. Joseph Shaw, chairman of the Latin Mass Society and formerly a member of the Faculty of Philosophy at Oxford. Many of us are glad for an interpreter to offer us an informed understanding of the historical context and both the politics and the theology that accompanies it, particularly since our audience for this podcast, while being mainly Catholic, is not exclusively so. We attract a number of listeners who very sensibly want to know more about the reality of the Catholic Church, and particularly how it relates to the stresses and strains of modernity, and postmodernity, if you believe in that. Academics like definitions, so let's begin with the Latin Mass Society's own definition of itself. Quote, "The traditional Roman Missal is the result of incremental and organic development from the time of Pope Gelasius, who died in 496, and Pope Gregory the Great died in 604. So it's sometimes called the Gregorian Rite. After the Council of Trent, a carefully revised edition of the Missal was issued by Pope St. Pius V in 1570, so it's sometimes called the Tridentine Rite or the Tridentine Mass. The way the Mass has been handed down over so many centuries is reflected in its name, the Traditional Mass. Pope Benedict XVI described it as a form or a use of the Roman Rite, and so it became called the Extraordinary Form or the Earlier Use, Usus Antiquor, of the Roman Rite. In Summorum Pontificum, Article 1, the Holy Father ruled that this form of the Mass was never abrogated and had at no time ever been forbidden. In 2021, Pope Francis changed the legal framework of this liturgy again, ruling that it may be permitted for the good of souls in a letter to the bishops. And so it's now officially called the Former Missal, or the 1962 Missal. Then, out of the blue, Pope Francis launched severe restrictions against the celebration of the Latin Mass in parish churches throughout all the dioceses of the Church. Why? What does it signify? What will it mean? What will happen? Helping me solve all those questions is Joseph Shaw, who joins me now. Well, welcome, Joseph Shaw, President of the Latin Mass Society. We've met before, very briefly, in person, and it's very nice for me to meet you now electronically, with much more time to talk. I don't suppose when you became president of the Latin Mass Society, you thought you would find yourself at the centre of an ecclesial storm. But would you be so kind as to introduce yourself, to tell us a bit about how you joined the Latin Mass Society, how you became its president, and what the function of the society is? And then perhaps we might pick up some of the more contested issues that we've all got to manage, understand and deal with today. So who is Joseph Shaw? Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I should say I'm actually not president. I'm chairman. We don't have a president anymore. But I joined the Latin Mass Society as a schoolboy. Actually, I saw an advert somewhere and I just thought it was a nice idea. I didn't go to the traditional Mass. I didn't have the opportunity. And it was a long time later that I finally made it to a Mass. And when I did, it was in a municipal meeting room that you could hire by the hour. And it was with the permission of the Archbishop of Birmingham, because it was in Oxford. He'd given permission for this celebration, but he couldn't find a church for it to go in. So we just had to find our own space, and this was it. And it was very odd in that respect. But I went in and I fell in love with it. It had a profound effect on me, despite the lack of external advantages. I would say that In a way, it's not at all a matter of aesthetics. It's not at all about fine vestments and fine singing and stuff. It can be for some people, perhaps, but it certainly wasn't for me and for a lot of people at that time. Very rare for us to have good music, for example. But nevertheless, it impressed me by its solemnity. And that's what you'd always hear people saying, and you still hear people saying this, that it's very reverent. Pope Benedict uses the same kind of language, the sacrality. And it's actually pretty difficult to argue with that. Perhaps the people who don't like it or think that it shouldn't exist or shouldn't be celebrated don't really want sacrality. It's not that they didn't think it has this sacrality, it's just they didn't think that's a feature of liturgy which should be promoted. In any case, I became involved After that, I was drawn into helping to sing a Gregorian chant. I found myself made the local Latin Mass Society representative. And these things usually happen because there's no one else willing to do them. So that's certainly the case in my case. And then I found myself on the committee and then chairman. That was 2009. So I've been at it now for more than a decade. And actually, our dealing with crises is what the Latin Mass Society is all about. So I'm not surprised that I'm in the middle of a crisis because it's just one succession of crises. The Latin Mass Society exists to make possible, to bring about as much as possible, the celebration of the traditional Mass within the structures of the Church. So with the permission of bishops, in churches, by priests of any legitimate, authorised, canonically regular variety that there might be, distinguishes our what we do from supporters of the Society of St. Pius X. We've always had this separate role. That doesn't necessarily mean we're hostile, but it does mean that we have a different role in the Church.
You're speaking very carefully, and so you should, but there are going to be some people listening to us who are not Catholics and or who are right at the beginning of the curve, or even who are thinking of becoming Catholics, and they'd very much like to know what the Society of St. Pius X does and what the distinction you've drawn about being within or without actually means. Could you just give a quick pencil sketch?
So that society, the SSPX, as it's usually called, they were founded by a missionary archbishop who had retired, Marcel Lefebvre, in Switzerland immediately after the council, in order to give seminarians a more traditional formation, which they were asking for. And after a few years, he realized that he wanted to use the older kind of Mass rather than the Reformed Mass, because he thought that worked with the kind of spirituality he was promoting. And then a few years after that, he was officially suppressed. But being the kind of man he was, he didn't let that stop him. He just carried on. So you might say, well, from that point on, which I think was 1975, it was not in a regular canonical situation. So as time went on, the priests he was training were ordained. He ordained them, and that was without permission. And then eventually, I mean, to cut a very complicated story short, in 1988, he consecrated not just priests, but also four bishops, because he was conscious of his own mortality, and indeed he died in 1992. So this now exists with four bishops, well, in fact, three of them now, and it has its own priests, it has its own seminaries, and they take no notice of what the local bishop wants or doesn't want. They have to buy or hire places to have Mass. They have their own supporters, their own network, they have some schools. There are perhaps, I don't know, 400 or so priests under their authority, and there are various allied groups, religious communities, sisters, brothers of various kinds. Quite a few of them left and were received back into the fold, so to speak, by Pope John Paul II in 1988, which is when the Episcopal ordinations took place. And a whole lot more did the same thing in 2007 when Pope Benedict made it much easier to celebrate the traditional Mass, because they thought, well, the war's over now. We don't have to be on the outside of this structure, the canonical structure, the hierarchical Church. But not all were. The majority were not in both cases. So they still exist. And of course, now they feel vindicated.
But Benedict also took some serious steps to throw bridges across the divide of impaired communion too, towards the end.
Yes, he did. The four men who were ordained bishop in 1988, they were excommunicated, automatically excommunicated under the laws of the Church. And they claim, of course, that they weren't validly excommunicated for complicated reasons, but just leaving that aside. And Pope John Paul II reiterated this. So those excommunications were lifted by Pope Benedict. In fact, they were even before 2007. And in fact, this effort at rapprochement has been continued under Pope Francis. So Pope Francis gave all the priests of the Society of Pius X their faculty to hear confessions. That was something which wasn't really clear how that was working up until that point. But he's now given them faculties himself personally, which is not what priests normally have. Normally, priests have it from their local bishop. And he also made it possible for them to celebrate weddings in a way which would be recognised. So he solved two of their biggest practical problems, actually, in serving their own faithful. And it's a remarkable, generous and open-handed, open-hearted thing for him to do in the year of mercy. So when was that?
2016.
I think he hoped for a kind of rapid reconciliation without too much kind of bureaucracy. But it actually, that did not happen. And it's all the more surprising that since then, well, several years since then, 8 years into his pontificate, he suddenly decided to crack down on the mass, obviously for the reconciliation of people who are outside these canonical structures who like the traditional mass. The freedom of the traditional mass within the church structures is essential if they're going to be reconciled, if even going to think about being reconciled. And that's now down. At any rate, the SSPX works its work and we work ours.
That was very good indeed. So we can either go the chronological route of the conversation or follow the threads, the warm current. And you've introduced a very useful thread or a warm current as you've contrasted the generosity and hospitality of Pope Francis in, I think you're right, actually, I think it was 2015, but anyway, 2015, 2016, in the Year of Mercy. Do you have a view of your own about what led to this shift from gratuitous generosity to hard-nosed censorship? It's an odd journey for the Pope to have taken.
It's very odd. The explanation given by the documents themselves is astonishing. It says that the people have been instrumentalizing the traditional mass to cause division in the church, that some of them are characterized by views which reject the church in its normal form, but a talk instead of a kind of true church, which is hidden or separate or connected with the traditional mass. Now, those people with those sorts of views do exist. I can kind of recognize the kind of language he's using, but they don't exist within the boundaries of the hierarchical church. They don't come to the sort of masses that Latin Mass Society organizes. They exist on the wilder fringes of the world occupied by the SSPX. And of course, the SSPX aren't the most extreme people out there. There are people who are much more extreme
indeed,
who think the SSPX are kind of sellouts and liberals. So this always happens. So there are people who think the Pope isn't the Pope. There are people who have elected their own Pope in a garage in Minnesota and all kinds of crazy stuff. So if you go online and start poking about, you can find all kinds of people with all kinds of strange views, some of which are connected with the traditional mass, some of which are not. And there are plenty of people who don't believe that the church is a true church or the church has lost her way, who are liberals.
Sure, you know,
there are
indeed.
People who get themselves, you know, women who get themselves ordained, and also they say people who don't worship within the structures of the church in every possible direction.
Yes, it's a frame of mind rather than associated with a particular position. As you say, it can exist anywhere along the doctrinal spectrum. Do we have a view? Is there a view as to why the Vatican put up a straw man? Because as you quite rightly say, the parody of the Latin mass devotee that was used to justify it certainly doesn't apply to the faithful who worship in Latin mass inside the church. It might not even apply to the SSPX. But why bother with the parody then? What's it either hiding or being used to justify? What's the real motivation?
Well, after Tritius Caesaris came out, I went to him. I go to Rome regularly. I went along in October after that July, and thus had settled a little bit. People have time to think about it. And I asked everyone I met, you know, almost taxi drivers included, what this was all about. What was the motivation? Who's this aimed at? Someone was obviously annoyed at the Pope, and the Pope wants to deal with some group of people. And I've also, of course, been reading things that have come out in the public domain about it. But these conversations and this reading suggest to me very clearly that there is not a single clear official line on this.
Gosh.
So you ask five well-informed people and you will get at least six answers. What that suggests to me is that perhaps this was the result of a coalition of people who had different views, different objectives, but they thought this would be useful to them. Maybe the Pope is making a concession to a group of people who, you know, have all sorts of different reasons for clamping down on it, or maybe they think it'll help them in the conclave. Maybe they think that, you know, maybe they're personally annoyed by something, or maybe they're ideologically concerned about the traditional mass. Certainly, there are people who are ideologically opposed to it, and they clearly did supply some of the language used in the document. So there's a man called Andrea Grillo, who's a professor of liturgy in Rome, and he invented the term, the unique expression of the Roman rite, as something to be said about the Novus Ordo, but not the Reformed Mass, that is, not the traditional Mass. And that language found itself in Traditionis Custodes. So they borrowed that. I don't know whether he was personally involved, but they said they used his phrase. But that doesn't mean that the Pope himself has suddenly been bitten by a kind of anti-traditional Mass bug. He had not cared about it, been quite happy to promote it, even in a certain way, as far as the SSB is concerned, for 8 years. So it's complicated. Of course, that makes it very difficult to deal with. Mm. What argument can you make against an amorphous kind of collection of different people who perhaps don't agree with each other about much? Yeah, the straw man, I think, is just convenient. The straw man is just, oh, well, what can we say about them to justify our harsh crackdown? Let's characterise them like the kind of the looniest people we can find on YouTube. And, you know, obviously there's a grain of truth in the connection, you know, so that'd be my view.
Well, that's very helpful, because life is often full of complexity, and the forces we struggle with are often not the ones we imagine them to be, but something more elusive and sophisticated. So it wouldn't be surprising if your notion of a coalition was one of the most sensible analyses in the present situation. It certainly appeals to me as well. It's coming at a great price, though, isn't it? I've been surprised that the bishops haven't responded with more energy to defend their diocese, to exercise spiritual and pastoral care over people who observe the Latin Mass. Could you tell me why you think it is that there hasn't been more of a creative interrogation of the way in which the strategy is being imposed than there has been, either from the bishops or from the laity?
Yes. Well, I think, actually, I mean, I don't want to come across to some of my own supporters as too weaselly and lickspittle here, but actually, I think that we have a lot to be grateful for to the bishops and to ordinary priests. They've had this document, Traditionis Custodes, now for 2 years. There's been a certain kind of ramping up of the rhetoric and the letters from Rome and new documents. And up until now, very few bishops have really used this as an opportunity to limit the amount of the number of masses in a serious way, particularly in this country. I say, actually, hats off to English bishops, and actually bishops even in places where you might think, well, the relationships is not so cozy, like France, Germany. United States is, of course, it's always more complicated in America because it's such an enormous bishops' conference. Bishops have a huge range of views there. So some have, most haven't. Now, this latest thing, this rescript, which came out just last week, introduces a new phase. But certainly up until this point, I think that the ideologically motivated people in the Dicastery for Divine Worship and elsewhere have been disappointed by the lack of progress. And that may be exacerbated by their fear that this pontificate is not going to go on for all that much longer. I do not want to speculate about the Pope's health, but obviously he's 85, and he's not going to go on forever. So I think that any new Pope is going to reassess it, and who knows what they'll come up with. So I think that there's a certain urgency among the people who are pushing this. Yeah, you're not going to get any kind of foaming kind of bishop-hating stuff from me.
Actually, it's very refreshing to have that said, because, you know, one would like that to be one's attitude to our episcopate. That's it's much more wholesome than the alternative. So thank you for saying it, and thank you for your perceptions. What was your view when you saw what the strategy of the Bishop of Springfield, Ohio, was to redesignate parishes, to take churches and say, well, okay, you're no longer a parish, you're an oratory or a semi-oratory or a hemidemi-semi-oratory. Or
right. He's within his rights, and he's thinking about a pastoral position of all kinds of masses and sacraments in his diocese in exactly the way that he has been formally asked to do. And I think those people on the internet, you know, in Rome, who are saying to themselves, he's deliberately kind of evading us by kind of legalistic means, actually what they're suggesting is that people should read between the lines of these documents, somehow kind of reverse engineer the kind of attitude of the Holy Father, which has not been put into legislation, and then apply that in a way which takes no account of their own diocese pastoral needs. And that is obviously completely contrary to the vocation of a bishop.
So to put it in more populist terms, this sounds like it's fin de siècle stuff. This is a bit, we experienced this at the end of John Paul II's pontificate, when there was a troika in charge and different people ran different things. We may not be exactly there yet, but your suggestion is we're moving towards that. And in one sense, that sounds like a note of optimism, because it means that, as you say, the window for those who are ideologically driven and who have their hands on the leaves of power at the moment is getting smaller. And if they can't achieve what they want to achieve within a certain period of time, then the whole position may change under the new pope, who will represent we have no idea what yet.
Yes, well, indeed, we will have to wait and see. If the troika idea is about Pope Francis not being in control, I would disagree with that. I think he's completely in control. I think that nothing happens without his oversight, but it does not follow that he's ideologically motivated or committed. I think that he could change his mind. I think he could decide that the policy has been administered badly. I mean, I met Cardinal Roach, and I've after Jutsis Cosellis, and I've been back a second time to the dicastery since then, and what they often say is, well, we were given this document and we tried to apply it. And I think in a funny sense, it's true. Surprisingly, some people might think it's surprising, but I do think it's true. They were given the document. Some of them maybe liked it ideologically, personally, but some people less so, perhaps. But the point is, they are trying to apply it. And it was given to them by the Pope. And I think this stuff, whether Cardinal Roach was overreaching, to be fair to him, and perhaps people are shocked at me wanting to be fair to him, I think he's trying to make it a success.
Oh, can you explain
in the sense that he wants something to happen as a result of this?
You mean he's a good administrator and he's been given a brief?
Well, let me express it slightly differently. I mean, I supposing someone said to me, you know, here's a document which has the stated aim of X, but it's not all that well drafted and it may not work. And I sort of look at it and months go by and it's not working because it doesn't really give right incentives or the right power to me or something. So I think, well, I might try and get it to work by kind of, you know, force of personality or rhetoric or creating new legal powers or something. I just try to get these things to work because that's my job.
So this sounds as though you're suggesting it's a tragedy. You know, we were only obeying orders. We were in fact conscientious. These were the orders we were given. It's not an ideal world, but that's all we were trying to do. So in this reading, Cardinal Roach would be a competent and forceful administrator who doesn't want to be bad at his job.
I don't want to say Roach is incompetent, but there was certainly a problem at the Dicastery of Divine Worship about canon law expertise.
But it wasn't improved by the way Traditionis Custodis was written.
No, it wasn't. The other thing there's a lack of in the Dicastery is liturgical expertise. They didn't take anyone on specifically for this task who had specific knowledge of the traditional mass. Looking at some of the things that have been written coming from Cardinal Roach and coming from the Dicastery, I don't think they have much knowledge of the traditional mass. So to take a trivial example, at one point Cardinal Roach said, of course, the traditional mass, they don't have specialist books. Everything's in the Missal. Well, yes, we do, actually. We have a book called an Evangeliarum. You know, we have a book called the Pontifical Canon. We have, you know, all these different liturgical books. It's not important, but it just struck me as odd. You know, here he is, and it's not him. It's he's got secretaries and subsecretaries and dog's bodies and English language and French language and all the rest of officials around him who should be assisting, advising, correcting, checking. It's not working all that well because the expertise does not exist. Before, when the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, as it then was in charge of the traditional mass, they had people who were experts in the traditional mass. And of course, they were traditionists. of course, they were sympathetic to, Summorum Pontificum and the aims of Summorum Pontificum. So it's actually quite difficult to find someone who's an expert in the traditional mass who doesn't like the traditional mass. So, but go back to your point about whether he's just a good administrator. And I being an administrator, having an administrative task to do is a separate question from ideological motivation. I'm not saying they're not ideologically motivated. I'm sure some of them are. But nevertheless, that isn't the kind of necessarily the key to understanding what they're trying to do or how they're trying to do it, because that's a variable, you know, it varies from person to person. And that's one reason why they're trying as hard as they are. I think some of them, people say that Archbishop Viola, the number two there, is quite ideologically motivated. I don't know him. I don't know whether that's true. But certainly some people are. But remember, Cardinal Roach, it seems a short time ago, perhaps that's because I'm getting old, but a short time ago, he was in charge of ISIL. He's became a hate figure for Catholics on the progressive end of the liturgical scale, because he was insisting on the word consubstantial and the word ineffable, and things like that. He was promoting the program of Pope John Paul II and Pope Benedict of re-sacralized liturgical language.
It sounds to me as though you're proposing an ecclesiastical version of chaos theory. a whole series of elements that are unrelated have come together, and out of the sort of concatenation of variabilities, we have a result. But the result, it wasn't always an obvious outcome from the variables. It just happens to be the result.
Yes, of course. I mean, that's always going to be the case. It's always going to be, whatever the Pope is, whatever he wants, he's going to be working with a variety of people. Pope Benedict was surrounded by people who didn't agree with his vision. In this case, so on the one hand, there's an attempt by the Dicastery to kind of make this happen. They got their work cut out in some ways because it wasn't well drafted, so they're trying again. And the rumours that we've now been hearing are about a much, much stronger document that would really, you know, put the skates under the whole process and really kind of drive Catholics who like the traditional mass out into the wilderness.
Or even the SSPX.
I suppose so. I mean, that would be, you know, one ultimate kind of end result. But I don't understand why Pope Francis would. I mean, he's still giving them this authorization to hear confessions. I mean, it's not just a one-off come to an end. He's still doing that. So he's supporting them. Is he trying to drive us into their arms? Is he really? Does he want to be responsible for a schism? I mean, 5 minutes ago, he was trying to heal the schism. I think every pope, Pope John Paul II, certainly Pope Benedict, were really upset about being the pope who failed to deal with a schism.
He did make that rather threatening remark about, I should quote him exactly, and I'm sorry that I can't, but you know, sometimes schisms have to happen. Live with it. And people said, well, why is he saying that to us? Is what does this mean? And it was one of his many enigmatic remarks that can be taken and used in a variety of contexts.
He said on one occasion, maybe I'll be remembered for causing a schism. And I think he was thinking more about the kind of Amoris Laetitia, German synodal way kind of issues. But you're right. It's so difficult to understand.
A lot of people will be very grateful that you're dealing with this in such an even-tempered way. No hysteria, no paranoia, no animus. And some almost, unless I've misread your tone, almost some optimism that, you know, everything will pass. I mean, is this something the Latin Mass trains you in? Well, it's been around for a very, very long time. and a bit like the sort of cloisters and arches of medieval buildings. It will see out the present incumbents. The shape will still be there. They'll just need to be rehabilitated. Is that your view?
Well, what I would say about the histories of the institutional memory of the Latin Mass society is it's a lesson of grim determination.
You're smiling a great deal for someone who's
grim. I am because it's thinking about that, you know, it was grim, absolutely grim for a lot of its history. And the same is true for Univece groups, Latin Mass Society groups all over the world. And I'm also president of the Univece International Federation, so I'm in touch with them and I talk to them a lot. And until 2007, it was just so awful, so awful.
Again, can you explain why?
It wasn't available. The Mass wasn't available. So they, you know, we begged the bishops, you know, my predecessors begged the bishops to allow it here or there or the other place, and the bishops would simply say no. And if priests wanted to sue it, they would realise they would get into terrible, terrible trouble if they did. A priest I know said he used to say it literally in a broom cupboard in the cathedral church where he was posted. Like, he was terrified of anyone walking in. Yeah, it was unbelievably grim. There were kind of an annual mass, you know, here and there. That's how it used to work. Quarterly mass, you know, mass on Wednesday afternoon. But it was an opening, and we maintained these masses, and we made sure there were servers and all that sort of thing, because it showed the mass had not been abrogated. The mass was not completely banned. We worked on it, and gradually, after 1971, we got the first kind of permission. It was very, very miserly applied. 1984, a little bit more encouragement. 1988, a bit more encouragement, but still very, very tough. 2007, suddenly the situation changed. And that was the fruit of staying in the game, that we hadn't gone away. We hadn't given up in despair. We had doggedly, we'd been insulted, we'd been ignored, we'd been abused in all sorts of ways. We've been given priests to celebrate Mass for us who didn't like us, for example, and, you know, said rude things about us, you know, as part of the sermon. We were given churches which were impossible to get to, had no facilities, no car parking, all those sorts of things. But we persevered, and we were vindicated. And we were still there. When the Pope, when the wind changed, when the situation changed, there was someone to whom the concession could be made. If we disappeared, that wouldn't have happened. So that's what we're all about. And of course, we've made the best of the opportunities that happened since 2007, and we will continue to do that. But making the best of it, that may not be very good.
Well, I'm halfway between the Four Yorkshiremen, Monty Python's Four Yorkshiremen sketch in my mind.
Yes, indeed.
or thinking of the underground church behind the Iron Curtain, where something, yeah. I used to make forays in the 1980s in the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia.
Oh yes,
and what I think to take a more responsible response to what you said, I'm astonished at the similarity between what you've been describing and the way in which the underground church in an atheist regime had to function. But you're obviously right. You're telling the truth. That's what happened. Do you have what's your sort of apologia for this, your explanation? Is it political, metaphysical, bad luck, the sort of exigencies of history? Do you have a sort of an analytical framework through which you see the flourishing or the non-flourishing of the Latin Mass in the history of the church in the West at the end of the second millennium?
Well, I do. In fact, I've got a book out. Readers may be interested to know the liturgy of the family and the crisis of modernity. But it's fairly systematic. And my thing is to connect the fate of the traditional Mass with modernism in a very broad sense, modernity. So the breakdown of social structures, the breakdown of family, the breakdown of all sorts of civic associations, the fact we don't know our neighbours anymore, the fact that local communities didn't exist in the same way, and all sorts of customs which were sustained by those things. This is part of the same process. So the different liturgical visions are, of course, there are all sorts of theological things as well going on, but one of the things that's going on is a modern mindset, in the sense of, if you think of in the 1950s, 1960s style, what do they think of as modern? Sort of cut down to the bone, aerodynamic. That's what we got. We got a mass that was supposedly adapted to the modern age. And that's all about being easy to understand, getting straight to the point, not having unnecessary repetition, all those things, rather than something that was artistic, elaborate, complicated, and profound. This has been the battle of the modern age. This has been the battle of the last 500 years between those two things. And both of them need to be understood in quite a complicated way, which we don't have time to kind of get into here. But this is one aspect of the battle of Western civilization, which is now, of course, world civilization.
In a sense, this is there'll be parallels in music, in architecture, in literature. It's the same form of grilled down brutalism that reflects the loss of the soul in modernity.
That's right. One of the things I've been researching, in fact, since finishing this book, I've moved on to another aspect of the thing. And one of the interesting things in the 60s and 70s was the willingness of artists to defend the traditional mass. And some of these were modernist artists. Well, what's a modernist artist doing being in favour of this kind of complicated, old-fashioned things, mass? Well, modernism in art is a rebellion against, sometimes, against modernity. Mm. It's a rebellion against the mass-produced, sentimental, chocolate box, inauthentic stuff of the, I don't know, early 20th century, late 19th century. And like T.S. Eliot, about the Anglican liturgy, he was asked to join a committee revising the Psalms, and he turned out to be the biggest traditionalist in the room. Mm. And the room included C.S. Lewis. Mm. So he was more of a traditionalist in the liturgy than C.S. Lewis was. Now, C.S. Lewis was an artistic traditionalist, didn't like T.S. Eliot's poems. But T.S. Eliot was a more profound sense. He used modern artistic forms to say something profoundly traditional. Now, you can use modern artistic forms to say other things as well, but you can attack traditional things with them. But insofar as they are a rebellion against modernity, actually, they look at the traditional mass, some of these artists, and they say, actually, this is what we like. This is not modern, and therefore, you know, it's good. It's authentic. It's not fake. It's not sentimental. It's not chocolate boxy. It's not those things, not bourgeois, all the sort of silly words that they invented to describe what they didn't like, which is somewhat amorphous and sometimes a bit unfair, I think, as well. But nevertheless, you know, that was their thing in the kind of mid-20th century, this big movement of, oh, let's get away from these awful old thatch cottage, you know, people talking in kind of fake old-fashioned English, all that sort of stuff. They didn't like it. Well, but they didn't like the kind of the bureaucratic, manufactured. So T.S. Eliot, I think, is a very good example, though not a Catholic. His writings, I mean, he was a convert. He became a profoundly pious Anglican at a certain point in his career, and his poetry reflects this. But even before his conversion, he saw the problem of modernity.
I have no doubt at all that both Lewis and Eliot would be Catholic today, even if it wasn't just a matter of development, but given that the ground under their feet was cut away as Anglicans. But leaving that to one side, one of the things that interests me from what you said is that there's an element of cultural context in this. One of the things that's happened in my lifetime is that the hierarchical and the transcendent and the orderly, which were presented as enemies to the quest for intimacy and informality of the 1960s. My sense in a slightly Jungian, there's always an attempt for a balance. And as you attempt, you know, you're always off balance as you look for the balance by definition. But one of the things that's happened is that cultural elements that were threatening after the destabilization following the Second World War have suddenly become life rafts. So the order of hierarchy, the notion of transcendence, the whole idea of the other, they've suddenly become enormously important as a vacuum of meaning that postmodernity has ushered in, leaves people desperate for some kind of handhold. And if that's true,
yes,
then isn't the Latin mass going to come into its own now? Is that the reason you're so calmly confident and so supremely benign? Because you know, as modernity collapses around you, that Latin mass effectively is a sacred life raft that people are going to be increasingly desperate to join.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And that is indeed my view. So you may know of Mary Douglas, Catholic anthropologist writing in the 60s. Mm. She was very critical of the liturgical reform. But she said, modern people, modern European, middle-class modern Europeans, are brought up in such a way they don't really understand hierarchy and ritual, whereas, you know, people in other societies do. And one of her things was that the liturgical reform was anti-Catholic working class, because she said the working class, they retain this respect for understanding of ritual, understanding of hierarchy, the father of the family, the head of the clan, who sits where around the table, all those sorts of things. Now, if you take Mary Douglas's view, then it could be very depressing, because obviously this middle class way of living has spread and taken over the whole world. But that it hasn't worked out the way that she might have expected. What's happened, in fact, is that this happy-go-lucky kind of, we're all equal, there's no hierarchy, there's no structure. It's spread so far that it's spread to people who don't like it. And now you have a lot of people who are hungry for something which they have not experienced very much at home. So when Mary Douglas said, well, of course, people who have a traditional upbringing, hierarchical family and stuff, they understand and appreciate traditional mass. Well, actually, what we're finding is that people who've been chewed up and spat out of a kind of awful, modern, formless, you know, non-family, they are desperately keen on it because they can see something for which they have a deep longing. And that shows to me that this is going to win. It's not necessarily going to take over the entire world, but it's always going to have a constituency because it's not just for something for people who have been brought up in a certain way or have a certain education can appreciate. It's not just for some sort of strange elite or maybe some sort of backwater of working class Catholics or anything like that. Actually, this is for a lot of people a life raft, exactly as you say.
Because if you're having to decide between order and chaos and you're surrounded by chaos, then the offer of order is the offer of sanity and very welcome. If you're having to decide between an excess of meaninglessness and a core of intense meaning, then once again, you're going to flee towards the meaning. So yes, the Latin Mass becomes an antidote to the collapse of modernity. Well, that may be a title for your next book, or if not yours, mine. Anyways.
Yes. It's one of these luxury beliefs. The rejection of order in the liturgy, and I don't want to say that Novus Ordo does this, but if you were to take it a step further, a kind of the radical liturgical progressive doesn't want any order at all. So the Novus Ordo is far too ordered for them. Reject all the rules, of course they do. You see these liturgical abuses and stuff. So it's a luxury social cultural practice because you can only do that and get away with it if you have all sorts of things like education and money and social connections and stuff, which most people don't have and couldn't ever have. But if you have that, it's like the people who can get away with endlessly having divorces and affairs and stuff. Well, who survives best out of that is the people with money, the people who can shore up the problems with, you know, nannies and boarding schools and, you know, at least I can pay for you to have an education, all this sort of thing. Whereas the people who are, you know, the other end of the socioeconomic scale, they get into that situation and they're destroyed by it.
Yeah,
so they can't afford, ordinary people can't afford chaos.
Immoral chaos, this kind of liberal, yes.
Chaotic thing.
One of the ways in which I've seen it, it's a little oversimplistic, but again, it's the balancing of poles, and it had something to do with transcendence and immanence. But if the Novus Ordo and the whole momentum of reform was intended to provide more immanence to balance the transcendence, it failed because it mistook immanence for entertainment. And so instead of providing us with a sacred form of immanence, it provided a degree of vacuous entertainment or a kind of an empty bonhomie, and therefore produces a desert of sacred encounter, leaving, if you like, all the sacred chips on the side of the transcendent and of the Latin Mass. And I think that's one of the reasons, as people have a hunger for transcendence, there is nowhere else to go apart from what the Latin Mass represents.
Yes, I'm not sure how useful the transcendent immanent distinction is. And I've come across this before in the kind of liturgical context, people saying traditional Mass is all about transcendence. I'm not really sure what that really means. And obviously there are kind of symbols of transcendence, but there's also, I would say, a lot of immanent, because God is brought into the ordinary things in the Mass. He's brought into the bread and wine. And that seems to be an example of immanence to me, if that word means anything at all.
You're quite right. That's the limitation of treating it. So I suppose what one ought to say, really, is that the both cultural attempt ought to deal with transcendence and immanence in their own terms. The Mass will always be an act of transcendence, even in Novus Ordo, because of what it is. And as you quite rightly say, there will always be immanence because God draws close in an intimate way. But what we're left, given the failure of modernity, it's only the Latin Mass that has survived to provide a balance of authentic transcendence and immanence. Yes, I mean, that's obviously a much more accurate way of describing the dynamics.
Maybe what's what people are trying to express with this distinction is more like this. So what you find even in official documents sometimes is this idea that the Novus Ordo, the liturgical reform, was designed to bring God into the everyday life of worshippers, with a view to making it easier for them to then bring that liturgical experience into the rest of their lives. So the idea was that if you associate God with pottery chalices, ordinary day clothes, either sitting around in a circle, those sorts of things, then that's easier to penetrate your ordinary life. Whereas you have this kind of very weird experience in church, you go out and how's that going to apply to the rest of your life? And I think that, well, the examples I've used, of course, is that shows that one limitation of that is because actually you're not allowed to use pottery chalices. I mean, people do use them, but actually it's against the rules and they are supposed to wear proper vestment. So this program was very limited in its application, and unless people were prepared to break the rules. Some people were, of course. It still didn't seem to work all that well. Whereas the model for the older liturgy was that you were taken into a very different space. You went up the sacred mountain. You had this experience where God was there at a kind of distance, but you could go to join him. You could participate with him. And why did anyone think that this could not be transformative for the individual? Funnily enough, one of the surprising liturgical resources that I found, a commentary on the liturgy, is actually John Paul II. And what he said about the liturgy of the Christian East, he said that you experience it. It enters into you with your whole being, precisely because you can't understand it, precisely because of the repetition and the kind of the lengthy duration and the kind of all kind of encompassing, kind of overwhelming nature of the chant and the, you know, the words and the smoke. And I mean, he didn't say it in quite this detail, but I mean, that's obviously what he meant. So you engage with it with your whole person, tota persona. So actually that's absolutely right. And that's what happens at the traditional mass. And that has transformative potential. Moses comes down from that mountain a different man, just like he does when played by Charlton Heston. You may have seen the Ten Commandments film. There's an amazing thing. He goes up there and he looks a bit relatively normal. He comes down, he looks slightly like a kind of mad, holy old man, which is how he plays it the rest of the film. But it's true. It's absolutely right. Moses goes up that mountain, an ordinary guy. He comes down from the meeting God in the burning bush, and nothing is the same again. And that's what the Mass is like.
I think we should give the last words to Moses, Charlton Heston, and John Paul II, courtesy of Joseph Shaw. Joseph, thank you very much indeed for a really marvellous conversation.
You're very welcome.
I've been greatly helped by it, and I'm sure a lot of other people listening will be very grateful too for everything you've brought to it. So thank you very much indeed. God bless you.